Geekscape.com. The Races of America, Part 5. The Islands, Past and Present. The West Indian Islands, first discovered by the Spaniards, then conquered by France, or England from Spain, or made the subjects of diplomatic transfer to European powers, are nestled in the bosom of the continent, and though not long since, save perhaps the silver mines of Mexico, were the most important portions of the New World, they are now, except Cuba, an almost absolute loss to the civilization of our times. As we have seen in the history of the mainland, that the Spanish civilization culminated with the overthrow of the Spanish dominion and the consequent rapid decline of mongrel republicanism, so too, the history of these islands is necessarily divided into their normal and abnormal conditions, or in other words, into the natural and legitimate rule of the master race and the abolition of that rule, and consequent ruin of these fertile and beautiful islands. The Moors that conquered Spain were accompanied by Negro domestics, and a very considerable number of these child people were left in Moorish families after the general expulsion under Ferdinand and Isabella. Common sense and the nature of things always govern our actions, unless there is some great accidental or selfish influence brought to bear to prevent or overrule them. Thus, in the thousands of years that the white man was in juxtaposition with Negroes, the Hebrews, Romans, and Saracens, no such stupid notion as free Negroism ever existed, and all through the Bible and Roman and Arabian history, no trace of any such monstrosity as a free Negro can be found. They were widely different and subordinate beings, and common sense and the nature of things taught all to regard and treat them as God had made them and adapted them, servants, domestics, miners, in fact. When, therefore, Columbus and his followers landed in Hispaniola, or the present Haiti, they were accompanied by some of their Negroes, who instead of dying of fever, like the Spaniards, were seen to be more vigorous, contented, and happy under the burning suns of the tropics than they were in Spain. This impressive fact taught the Spanish adventurers the immense advantage of African labour over that of the feeble and decaying native islanders. Las Casas and other friends of the natives readily assented to the introduction of African Negroes, but it was a great industrial necessity, rather than any sentimental feeling for the native, that promoted the importation of those whom God has specifically adapted to tropical production that originally brought the Negro to the New World. The King of Spain was applied to for his permission, and the importation of African labourers began, carefully and kindly guarded, and compared with which our present importation of our own wronged and outraged kind from the Old World is cruel and inhuman. Years after, it fell into the hands of the Dutch and English, and the African trade, becoming a mere matter of merchandise, enriched not only Queen Elizabeth and her partner, Sir John Hawkins, but was a source of great profit for several generations to the mercantile oligarchy. And indeed, some of the largest fortunes in England at this day had their foundations laid in the so-called slave trade. The islands of San Domingo, Jamaica, Cuba, Trinidad, indeed the whole West Indian group of islands, were soon supplied with African labourers. Plantations were opened, roads constructed, bridges built, and great and flourishing towns grew up all over these islands. The almost constant wars going on between European powers, and especially English piracy, thinly disguised under the mask of mercantile enterprise, did, it is true, greatly interfere with industry and production in these islands, but their great fertility and the European demand for their products overcame all these embarrassments, and a wonderful prosperity prevailed for more than two centuries. Port-au-Prince, Kingston, Santiago, and other principal ports became the great centres of modern commerce, and when New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and other cities of the British provinces in the north were almost unknown to the commercial world, the former were overflowing with wealth and magnificence. Indeed, and in fact, what we call commerce in our times had its origin wholly in that tropical production which followed the introduction of African labour in the New World. The popular notion of the East Indian trade, of great commercial cities of Tyre and Sidon, and indeed of Venice and Genoa of medieval times, is founded on a mistake. In those times, commerce was confined to diamonds and precious stones, with a few fine silks, linens, and rich essences used by kings and nobles, with little or no resemblance to what we call commerce now, of which the tropical products of cotton, sugar, coffee, and indigo, with innumerable ships and vast multitudes of employed people, form the material. There is probably more commerce in 1 week in New York or other great commercial centres of modern times than medieval Venice or Genoa saw in a century. And that supposed Indian trade that some have fancied was less imposing than that of the Jew peddlers of this day. Commerce proper was in fact unknown before the discovery of America and the introduction of Negro labour in the great tropical centre of our continent. The opening of the mines and product of the precious metals on the mainland, the introduction of Negro labourers in the islands, the supplies needed for Europe, and above all, the exchange of the product of their labour, developed a commerce that built up great cities, called into existence a vast commercial marine, hitherto unknown, and while giving employment to vast numbers of people, it rapidly modified all the features of our modern civilization. It is true, this grand commerce has disappeared from the great tropical centres of our continent, but England has only transferred her portion of it to the East Indies, and the wonderful increase of the Negro population and the equally wonderful development of the cotton production in the tropical districts of our own country have preserved it to the civilization of our times. All the islands were full of life, action and progress, and when New York and Boston were unknown to commercial Europe, Vera Cruz, Kingston, Port-au-Prince, and other ports in the West Indian Islands were the very centre of trade and commercial activity. There was one feature of the African trade, however, that was wrong, exceedingly so, and its consequences were deeply demoralising to these islands. It was right, of course, to bring the Negro from Africa, for otherwise a vast proportion of the most fertile and genial portion of America must needs be a desert waste prowled over by wild animals. The imported Africans were always better treated on the passage than our own hapless brothers and sisters that escape from European oppression and seek new homes in America. The horrible cruelties of the African slave trade that have been dinned into the ears of the world for so long, so loudly and persistently, were the result of abolition interference with that trade, and prior to such interference, it is repeated, the Negroes were treated better on the passage from Africa than Germans and Irishmen are in these days. Common sense says this to every cool and thoughtful mind. The coarse and brutal master of a ship, whose property interests are all wrapped up with the lives of his passengers, would, of course, look out for their health and well-being, while the man whose highest interest it is to starve and neglect those who had paid him for their passage would be apt to do so. Indeed, self-interest impelled the utmost care of the Negro and the utmost cruelty to the Irish or German emigrant. For while the former was rewarded by the highest possible price on landing, if the latter died on the passage, it was a certain amount saved out of the expenses of transporting him to America. But as observed, there was an unnatural and sinful feature of the African trade. Adult men paid better, and after this trade fell into the hands of the English, they mainly introduced males only. This was a great wrong, indeed a monstrous crime against nature and the will of the Creator. The sexual relations of husband and wife, parent and child, were thus denied to these people to a great extent, and it rendered them sullen and unhappy, and indeed less available as labourers. Unlike the happy, healthy, and contented Negroes in our own states, they were denied the great natural right to fulfil the prime command to multiply and replenish the earth. And the planters, instead of depending on the natural increase of the Negro people, relied on the African trade to supply the vacancy in the labour markets. It was a monstrous outrage, and aside from its positive effect in rendering the Negro less useful as a labourer, it shut out all those family influences and indeed affectionate associations, which, as we have seen among the planters of the South, grew up between the planters' families and their servants, which rendered a Southern household so attractive to all thoughtful and candid minds. But notwithstanding this demoralizing practice of introducing mainly adult males and the almost constant European wars that subjected their West Indian dependencies to the chances of invasion, plunder, and desolation 100 years ago, all these islands were full of life, progress, and prosperity. San Domingo, or Haiti, naturally the most fertile and prosperous, furnished all the sugar consumed in France, while her coffee plantations supplied the continent with the choicest coffee, and her indigo crop was relied on by the whole world for that special article. In short, these islands and this Negro labour, directed and controlled by the brain of the white man, furnished nearly all the materials of modern commerce, and without which the New World, or the most fertile portion of it, that which a beneficent creator has endowed with indigenous products essential to human happiness, would have remained a barren waste. But a sinister and fatal enterprise was now about to begin, which, under the mask or in the name of religion and philanthropy, has worked out results so horrible as well as ruinous that in comparison it would have been better for the white people of these fertile and beautiful islands to have been at once engulfed in the ocean surrounding them. The British colonies in the north had cast off the British dominion and established independent states instead of dependent provinces, and for the first time, the Old World and the New were brought face to face in an irrepressible conflict that, openly or secretly, has gone on ever since, and that must go on until one or the other is conquered and our modern civilization is a unit. In other times, Asia might borrow from Africa, or Europe overrun Asia, and then each settle down into a certain independence of each other. But in our times, with steamboats and railroads and telegraphs, and above all the printing press, civilization tends to unity, and especially in Europe and America, and therefore, with their politics and institutions so radically opposed, there must be conflict until one or the other is overthrown. Prior to 1776, there was peace, if not harmony, between the Old World and the New, and it is safe to say that if we had remained subject to the British Dominion, the world would never have heard of the great anti-slavery enterprise, nor at this moment would there have been such a social monstrosity as a free Negro in all America. But with the establishment of American independence, hostile systems came into conflict, and however unknown to themselves, the aristocrats of Europe were forced into a so-called anti-slavery policy, in very self-defense, against the dreaded march of democracy. Their system consists of unnatural distinctions of kings, lords, and commons, in our own race, while ours, based on the natural distinctions that separate races, demands equality of rights for white men, and therefore Pitt and Wilberforce began their warfare on the latter to save the former. Fortunately, too, for the English oligarchy, Clive had just conquered India, and therefore, with tropical Asia in their possession and 100 million Mongols to labour for them, they could not only afford to consult their political interests, but it actually became a commercial speculation to ruin their own West Indian islands. England desired to preserve her commercial supremacy, only possible, of course, by a monopoly of tropical production, and if in possession of tropical Asia and countless millions of Mongols, she could annihilate tropical production in America. Of course, the ruin of a few islands in the Caribbean Sea was actually desirable, especially when such stupendous political interests were combined with the grandeur of her commercial projects. She had only to destroy the Negro labor of America, to monopolize tropical production and modern commerce, and even if she failed to delude us and ruin our democratic institutions, she could transform the great tropical center of our continent into an African heathenism, which would present an immovable barrier against a further march of American democracy. Masking all this under the guise of religion and philanthropy, and taking advantage of the European ignorance and misconception of the Negro, the monstrous conflict against American civilization began by demanding that the French Convention should apply its principles to San Domingo, then the most productive and flourishing island of the whole West Indian group. The Negro is as incapable of insurrection against the rule of the white man as the child is against that of the adult. But when the latter abdicates his natural mastership, guidance, and protection of this subordinate Negro, then he instinctively strives to exterminate him. This followed in San Domingo. Every single white man, woman, and child was massacred or driven from the island, and a terrible lesson yet to be learned by some of our own people, those who treated their Negroes best and sought to conciliate them were the earliest and most certain victims of that bloody and remorseless spirit of extermination that is always called into action when the white man abdicates his natural rule over these people. After the whites were massacred, the mulattoes and Negroes came into collision, and the former were driven into the eastern portion of the island. The Negroes are now in undisturbed possession, with some white blood on the coast and in the towns mixed with the Negro. There is yet some approach to the forms of civilization, but in the interior they have returned to their African habitudes of obeism and snake worship, and a few years hence, when the slight infusion of Caucasian blood is extinct, they will differ in no respect whatever from those African populations that the Livingstones, Baths, and others have been so deeply interested in. Production proper has ceased absolutely and entirely, and an Ireland that, under the care and guidance of the white man, furnished France with sugar and coffee, and the whole world with indigo, now does not export a single pound of either. The frightful massacres that attended the abolition of white supremacy in San Domingo taught European governments one lesson, at all events, that they could not abolish the natural control of the white people over the Negroes without protection against the ferocious and brutal spirit of extermination so hideously displayed in San Domingo. Garrisons were therefore provided in all the other islands, and save that of Jamaica a few years since, there have been no serious or extended conflicts. But the white, rapidly, and even the Negro, slowly, perishes, and it is only a question of time when the former becomes extinct. Some of the smaller islands, under severe vagrant laws, have been to some extent successful, it is said, but whatever the extent of production, it is mainly from the introduction of coolies, a crime against these poor creatures, and a sin against God, compared with which even the horrors of the slave trade, through abolition interference, were insignificant. The Negro brought from Africa was still in his own centre of existence, but the coolie, without the protection of owning his services, without a wife or children, or hope of them, indeed, with every possible motive to work him to death, was brought into a centre of existence where, even with the utmost care and kindness, and wife and children to boot, he cannot become a permanent population. But ignorant of all this, with their lands lying idle, their plantations going to waste, with nothing but the idle and useless Negro, only working when the pressure of necessity prompts him, it was very natural that the despairing planters of the West Indian Islands would strive to bring in coolies from Asia, if permitted to do so, even temporarily. The end of this policy, impiety, fraud, hypocrisy, ignorance, and lunacy, is obvious and inevitable. The rapid decay of the white and mongrel elements must, within a few brief years, place all these islands alongside of Haiti, and the great tropical centre of our continent must become a second Africa. A huge heathenism, differing in no degree whatever from that which for thousands of years, and indeed from the starting point of authentic history, has marked the condition of the isolated Negro. But such stupid, foolish, fathomless, and limitless lies have been invented, such incongruous, impossible, and shameless falsehoods concocted and imposed on the world, indeed such stultified and well-meaning self-deception, as well as designed and deliberate fraud, have deluded the reason and perverted the moral sense of mankind on this subject, that even now, with all these islands rapidly drifting to Africanism, there are travellers and writers of books who give plausible pictures of the success of abolition, and indeed who parade statistics and prove the prosperous condition of some, and explain satisfactorily why freedom has failed in other islands. Of course, they take the French islands, or the remote ones, those the people know least of, and where their preposterous tales cannot be tested or exploded. It is not necessary to go into detail to demonstrate the total, and indeed unavoidable, necessary ruin of civilization in the fertile and beautiful islands which a beneficent providence has designed for the happiness and well-being of his creatures, but which a mad and monstrous impiety has doomed to a rapidly approaching death and desolation. It will suffice, in conclusion, to briefly present the three most important islands, and best known to us, Cuba, Jamaica, and Haiti, right here before us, that illustrate perfectly the past, present, and future of the entire group, and indeed all tropical America. Cuba is now just where all the islands were before the monstrous abolition policy began. The condition of the Negro is greatly inferior to the condition of this element in Virginia. Indeed, relatively considered, the condition of the Negro in Virginia was as far superior to that of the Negro in Cuba as that of the citizenship of the former was superior to that of the white subjects of the latter, or as democracy is superior to monarchy. Nevertheless, Cuba is at this moment overflowing with life, industry, and progress, supplying nearly all the sugar we ourselves consume, and Havana is the center of magnificent commerce. Jamaica, on the contrary, with its white population of 27,000 when abolition took place, reduced to 13,000, and its dilapidated and decaying towns, is rapidly drifting to the condition of Haiti. If the British government were to withdraw its troops, the whites would be massacred or driven from the island within the next 90 days. And otherwise, the same ratio of decline as for the last 40 years must soon give the island over to the Negroes and consequent heathenism. Indeed, it were better, certainly better, for the Negroes to be relieved from the temporary burden of mongrelism now imposed upon them, and their revolt a few years since was a natural and instinctive movement to slough it off. Isolated and left to their natural aptitudes, they live and slowly multiply, but burdened with the presence of mongrels and whites who abdicate their natural duties of rule and guidance over these people, they also decline in population. But in any event, the presence of the white man is brief and limited in Jamaica, and with his extinction, the Negro relapses or returns to his original Africanism, already reached in the interior of Haiti, and a few years hence, certainly within the next 50 years, save Cuba, the whole great tropical center of our continent must needs become a huge African heathenism, and as utterly lost to America as if engulfed in the Atlantic Ocean. The facts, the palpable material facts that now confront us south of our own borders on this continent necessarily involve the inference or inductive fact that within a certain period, certainly less than a century, the white blood will be extinct, and the native Indian population must then collapse into the same useless savages they were found by the Spanish adventurers in the 15th century. The actual existing palpable facts that confront us in the islands, save Cuba, necessarily involve the conclusion that the white blood must be extinct within a given period, probably within the next 50 years, and then the Negro, left to his own natural aptitudes, will be again a snake worshipper and Obi man, but he will then recover his vitality and, as in Africa, multiply himself. What is to be the future civilization of America, thus penned up by a vast Indianism on the mainland and the great tropical center of the New World transformed into a huge Africanism? There is no speculation or supposition, or room for supposition in this matter. It is a mere matter of fact and inductive fact of things and the nature of things, of existing circumstances and of unavoidable necessity. In short, it is cause and effect, and is inexorably linked together, as disease and death, mongrelism, must die out, and the Indian and Negro south of us must collapse into their original Indianism and Africanism, and the continent and islands south of our own borders be as utterly lost to American civilization as if swallowed up by the oceans that surround them. Nor is there any doubt, or room for doubt, in regards to their condition, when the white blood is extinct. The Indians must be just what he was before the Spanish conquest, and the Negro must be exactly what he is now in Africa, when isolated and left to his own guidance, a simple, useless heathen, without even a capacity to invent an alphabet, just as he has been in the entire past, and just as he must be forever, short of a recreation and a new universe altogether. Is it to be supposed for a moment Yet American civilization is to be dwarfed and permanently overshadowed by this gigantic heathenism, filling up the great center of the continent and casting its portentous shadows over the fairest portion of the New World. Is it to be supposed that these vast regions, which a beneficent creator has endowed with such wonderful fertility and made the center of life to produce so essential to human welfare, are to be abandoned wastes and lost to his creatures? Is it to be supposed that all the elements of that mighty modern commerce which first sprung up in the New World and have so modified the civilization of our times are to be lost to us, and England, the author of all this gigantic ruin through her East Indian possessions, is to enjoy a monopoly of tropical production, and with it the commerce of the world? Is it to be supposed that the laboring and producing classes of America, the farmers of the Great West and the toiling mechanics of the great cities, are to be dependent on English merchants for sugar, coffee, cotton and rice, or in the enhanced prices of these great staples so essential to their happiness, to go without them altogether? Finally, is it to be supposed that the real friends of humanity will stand stupidly looking on while the subordinate races of this continent are drifting back into their original savagery, and instead of civilized and useful beings, permit obeism and snake worship to darken the great tropical center of America? No! A million times no. The absolute necessities of American civilization, the imperative laws of self-preservation, the instincts of nature, and veritable commands of God himself, ordain that we shall restore industry and production and prosperity to these fertile and beautiful regions, and render them available for the well-being of God's creatures. Again, the white supremacy will exist. Again, the subordinate races will be governed, guided, and protected by those on whom, in endowing them with a higher nature, God has imposed this duty of government. Again, these now blighted regions will be the center of a mighty production and a vast commerce, and indeed, it is only a question of time when the Gulf Coast must become the Mediterranean of the New World. On the same line of latitude, and with the same products as the Old World, the great central and western states of the American Union have little to exchange, and a time must come when American manufacturers will be so advanced that commerce with Europe must be of small concern. But the West needs the cotton, sugar, coffee and rice of the tropics, and the latter needs the beef and pork and breadstuffs of the former, and nature has furnished the mighty river for the exchange of these products, and a commerce compared with which all that the world has yet seen, or that 1,000 Pacific railways could do, were absolutely insignificant. When the great Mississippi Valley, the vast region from the Alleghenies to the foot of the Rocky Mountains, is exchanging its products for those of the great tropical centers of our continent, when farmers on the headwaters of the Mississippi and the toiling multitudes of our great northern cities can be supplied with cotton and sugar and coffee and the rich fruits of the tropics at merely nominal prices, and the poorest laboring man enjoy comforts that kings and nobles could not a few centuries ago, then, it is repeated, the Gulf Coast, the center of this mighty commerce, must needs become the center of American civilization, and just what a beneficent providence designed it should be when endowing those beautiful regions with such wonderful fertility.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.